We will take care of everything from free pickup to sending you your tax paperwork. That number again to call is 877-KPFK-AUTO for auto, and we will take care of your old gas guzzler.
Yeah, this is Ziggy Marley. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. It's really powered by the people. Keep it locked.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. According to the annual census conducted by the Committee to Protect Journalists, as of December 1st, there were 259 journalists jailed worldwide, the highest number on record. Turkey is holding the largest group of 81 journalists, followed by China with 38 and Egypt with 25. They are followed by Iran with 8, Israel, Syria, and Bahrain are each holding 7 journalists. Among those currently detained in Israel is Omar Nizal, who was arrested by the Israeli military in April, traveling from the occupied West Bank to Jordan en route to a meeting of the European Federation of Journalists in Sarajevo. Since then, Nizal has been held in administrative detention without charge or trial. In November, Israel renewed Nizal's administrative detention for an additional 6 months. In the weeks before his arrest, Nizal had shared statements on Facebook criticizing Israel's crackdown on Palestinian media. Last August, Israel's Public Security and Interior Ministries set up a joint task force to deny entry to or to expel foreign activists allegedly affiliated with organizations that support BDS, or boycotts, divestments, and sanctions of Israel. This is widely seen as part of a broader crackdown whose primary targets are Palestinians. Though last month, Nitzan Shen, the director of the Israeli government press office, said that he was leaning against renewing the press card of Anthony Lowenstein, an independent Australian journalist currently based in the Middle East. It's believed that if Lowenstein's press card is not renewed when it expires in March, the Interior Ministry will not allow him to remain in Israel. In February, the Committee to Protect Journalists condemned Israel's intimidation of the international media, including threats to revoke the credentials of reporters who published headlines Israeli officials don't like. Today, we will discuss Israel's crackdown on free speech with a friend of the show and the reporter currently in the crosshairs of the Israeli government press office, Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony is a Middle East-based Australian freelance journalist, author, documentarian, and blogger. He has written for The Guardian, The New York Times, Al Jazeera, Salon, and The Nation, as well as many other publications. He's the author of 3 best-selling books, My Israel Question, The Blogging Revolution, and Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. Lowenstein is a contributor to the 2008 Verso release, A Time to Speak Out on Israel, Zionism, and Jewish Identity. His 2010 ABC Radio national feature documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, was a finalist in the UN Media Peace Awards. He's the co-editor with Ahmed Moore of After Zionism, a collection of essays by the world's leading writers and thinkers on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And he's currently working on a documentary film with New York-based filmmaker Thor Newrider, based on his 2015 book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, which is just now out in paperback. From Jerusalem, I'm very happy to welcome Anthony Lowenstein back to Middle East in Focus.
Very detailed biography. Thank you. Hello.
Hey, Anthony. I think it's very important for people to understand that you're an extraordinarily accomplished journalist that is now in this, situation.
Yes.
So if we can zoom out for a second, as we've been discussing on the show for the better part of last year, a very public crackdown on media, social media posts, and Palestinian rights activism in general in Israel. But you're someone who has spent a considerable amount of time there over the past decade. So can you talk a bit about the changes you've witnessed in the past year or so?
I can. So I started coming to Israel-Palestine in 2005, and I've been coming here every 4 years or so. Israel, the West Bank and Gaza. I've been living in Jerusalem pretty much for most of last year, 2016. And there's no doubt there's been a shift. I think one of the things that's really important, and you said this in your introduction, is that most of the attacks by the Israeli state intelligence police is against Palestinians. That's undeniably true. Those who are in prison, those who are allegedly inciting on Facebook. Of course, Facebook didn't exist many years ago, but in the current political climate, there are increasing moves, though, of course, against Israeli citizens, full stop, Jewish and Arab. And I think one of the things that is reflected in that is that Israel itself has become far more right-wing and intolerant of dissent. And the reasons for that, I think, are many. But I think, in short, it's partly because I would argue there's very little pressure internationally to change the country's direction. Let's not forget, 2017, this year, New Year, is the 50th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory in the West Bank and Gaza. 50 years is not temporary. 50 years is permanent. And maybe not forever. Forever is a very long time. But for the indefinite period, the occupation is permanent. And the effect of that, socially, militarily, politically, spiritually, I would say, has been so coarsening and so bankrupt that the effect of within the Israeli Jewish society has been to be increasingly critical of those who are against what Israel is doing. And that, I think, is directed, obviously, at Palestinians themselves, who are either protesting in the West Bank against house demolitions or against a lack of resources or the fact that settlements are expanding. And we should never forget that despite the recent comments by John Kerry, the outgoing Secretary of State, and the UN vote, which was very much against the settlements, and I support both those things, the truth is the Obama administration has been a complete disaster for the Palestinians because the settlements have hugely expanded. And Netanyahu, who's Israeli Prime Minister, has been here in power for a number of years now, has really entrenched not just the settlements but also a growing intolerance of dissent amongst his right-wing coalition. So the picture here is pretty grim, and although it's, as I said, primarily directed at Arabs and outsiders who want to come into Israel, that could be tourists, that could be Jews. I mean, Jews are also blocked from entering the country who are seen to be too critical. I mean, Noam Chomsky, a few years ago, arguably the most famous intellectual alive, was banned from entering Israel for some absurdly spurious reasons, and many, many others. It's a grim picture, and I think it's only going to get worse.
Yes, and on Thursday, the U.S. Congress passed a resolution condemning the U.N. resolution. They further make your point. We're also seeing within the U.S., the U.S. State Department denying visas to Palestinian activists seeking to come here to do speaking tours. I know that Israel restricts the movement of Palestinians within the occupied territory, Israel, and in and out of Gaza. Do they also systematically restrict Palestinians from traveling abroad?
Well, very much so. I mean, it depends, of course, where those Palestinians are living. If they're living in Israel proper, of course, it's much easier, though not clearly impossible for Israel to block them, to leave. If you're living in Gaza, and I was in Gaza a few months ago doing some work as a journalist, and the restrictions on Gaza for Gazans getting in, getting out, have never been tighter. There's been a blockade on Gaza since 2007, which is now, of course, the 10-year anniversary this year. And since Avigdor Lieberman, who became the defense minister in Israel last year in 2016, many people within Gaza, including the UN, told me that, and the figures bear this out, that there's never been a more difficult time to be a Gazan, both leaving and coming back, and also materials which are being very restricted entering Gaza, either from Egypt or Israel, to rebuild countless homes that were destroyed in the three wars that Israel has inflicted on Gaza in the last decade. So if you're in Gaza, your freedom of movement is a nightmare. Not saying no one gets out, they do, but it's very, very restricted, and often for reasons that are completely incomprehensible. Many Palestinian friends of mine there would tell me, Israel never gives a reason why you're maybe blocked. You may be told it's a security reason, but that's sort of default answer, which you can't get any more information about. If you live in the West Bank as a Palestinian, often there can be a restriction on getting access to Israel proper, let alone internationally. Can you even get a visa? Can you get a passport? all these key questions that, of course, are vital if you want to leave the country to travel internationally. So the restrictions on Palestinians themselves has never been tighter. And what's so disturbing and depressing is that the US is fully aware of this, not just during the Obama years, but for decades. It's never been worse, as I said, but it's incredibly bad now. And friends of mine who are living here in Jerusalem, or for that matter in the West Bank or Gaza, say if they try to contact the US embassy or consulate, that's of course in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, to try to get information, to try to get assistance to get Palestinians out, usually they are either given no response or a useless response. And the problem is that the US, with notable exceptions, has pretty much been content to go along with the Israeli restrictions, which really makes you question, as a lot of Israeli critical journalists say, who is the superpower here? Is it the US, who clearly is the more powerful player, or is it Israel, which is a tiny country in the Middle East with 8 million odd people? And arguably you'd have to say that Israel has incredibly disproportionate influence over the US, rather so much than the other way around. And that's only going to get worse, of course, with President Trump coming in a couple of weeks.
That's right. I have long said that Israel is not a foreign policy issue in the U.S. It's a domestic political issue. This is Middle East in Focus. I'm discussing Israel's crackdown on free speech with independent Australian freelance journalist Anthony Lowenstein, who's currently in Jerusalem. So to move to your current situation, three separate reasons have been cited in press accounts as to the reasons the Israeli government press office has threatened to revoke your press card. A challenging question you asked former Israeli government minister Yair Lapid at a press conference, a campaign targeting you initiated by a right-wing pro-Israel advocacy group that acts as a media watchdog, and a claim that you withheld information from the press office staff. Can you discuss your current situation with the government press office and why you believe you've become a target of theirs?
I can. So let me give the very brief version, because listeners will go to sleep if I give the whole version. So in short, I moved to Israel in early 2016. I had a legitimate visa. Before I even arrived, I began the process in discussion with the Israeli press office to try to get a press pass or press card, which essentially lasts for 12 months. I applied. I was given that press pass as a freelance journalist. I had no formal association with any news organization. I wrote on my application and gave information, which I have email evidence to show, that I've contributed to The Guardian, The New York Times, many others, but I was here as a freelancer, and I was given a visa as a freelancer. So that was in late March 2016. Fast forward to, and I had, I should say, no issues in the in those 9 or 10 months. I came in and out of the country. I traveled to the West Bank. I went to Gaza. There were no issues, as should be my right as an Israeli press card holder. And also that allows me to have a Israeli work visa, which lasts for a year as well. And about, I guess, a month and a half ago now, there was a press conference here in Jerusalem with Yair Lapid, who was a former minister in the Netanyahu government and is the leader of one of Israel's largest opposition parties, who could potentially be the next prime minister of this country. Who knows? As listeners may be aware, Netanyahu is currently embroiled in pretty crazy corruption scandal, which he's denied. So let's see how this plays out. But Yair Lapid could be the next leader of Israel. I asked a question at the press conference, which listeners can Google what it was. But in short, it was asking him the 50th anniversary of the occupation, and Lapid talked about Israel being a glorious, wonderful democracy, but for the millions of Palestinians under occupation, they of course would disagree. There are now 600,000 to 800,000 Jewish settlers living in the West Bank, all there illegally under international law. Does he not fear and think that in years to come, Israeli officials, including himself, could well face the kind of response that officials from apartheid South Africa got back in the day? In other words, they'd be ostracized and targeted for being supporters of discrimination. He hated the question, and he responded in a way that was, I would call, belligerent. And I took the answer and kind of went home, thinking that was the end of it. That night I got a call from the Jerusalem Post They were going to write a story about my question and the answer, which seemed like an absurd thing to do because it wasn't really even a new story in my view. The story came out, and this is where the smears began, that essentially claimed that I wasn't here legitimately, that I didn't have a legitimate visa, none of which was true. There were claims that I was alleging to be with The Guardian, which is not true. In my question, I clearly said I was a freelancer who contributes to The Guardian, which is true. It's a statement of fact. That story then morphed into the following week where another Jerusalem Post article appeared, had a quote from, as you read in your introduction, Esti, from the head of the press office here in Israel saying, because of my, I can't remember the exact words, but because of my alleged BDS, boycott, divestment, sanction activity, my views therefore were unacceptable, that when my press pass was up for renewal come March, April 2017, it would not be renewed. And I somehow didn't give full information. In other words, my background was not fully checked. Now, when I read that, this is a very revealing statement. And what that really says to people is that if Israel is going down the path that says my views somehow were unacceptable, and I should say, I have in the past supported BDS. It's on record. It's not a secret. It's on the internet. People can Google that. Nothing was held back. And also, but more importantly, I wasn't asked for my views about anything when I applied for a press card. In a democracy, we don't ask our views. If we're living in a dictatorship, then possibly you would. Israel claims to be a democracy. So, okay. So this happened. There was a mountain and avalanche of attacks by right-wing lobby groups against me, against organizations that I had written for. I then thought, okay, I need to fight back. So I contacted numerous free speech groups in the US and the UK and Australia, including leading groups who advocate either for the media or free speech, including the Committee to Protect Journalists, the ones who you quoted in your introduction. And they all either gave statements of support or tweeted comments that they were disturbed by the threats to expel me. And I should say that speaking to a number of Israeli journalists and others in the last month or so since this happened, it's not uncommon, as we've been discussing, that anyone can be kept away when they arrive at a border. That's not unique to Israel. Fine, I have a problem with that, but that's the nature of how it works. But the fact that I have a valid press pass, the fact that I got a valid visa, the fact that I have all the appropriate necessary documents to prove that I'm a freelancer with a record of 10 plus years reporting from across the world, it's quite unprecedented for a journalist like me to be threatened with expulsion. Now, I'm not saying, just to be clear, that I'm nothing like a Palestinian person who is clearly in a, often journalist, far worse situation. I'm not for a second comparing myself to a Palestinian in prison. I'm not claiming to be a victim here. I'm not. I'm a Jew living in a Jewish state. So the worst that could happen to me is I couldn't stay here, which is not a good situation, don't get me wrong. But ultimately, I think it goes to the bigger question here, which is Israel is moving to a situation, which is already happening for Palestinians, but I think it's going to happen more and more for both journalists and Israeli citizens. If your views are deemed unacceptable, if you're seen as being too critical, if you're seen as supporting BDS, if you're seen as being too critical of the state, and I should say in the context of that, listeners will be aware there was a big trial here in Israel which finished this week of a sergeant in Hebron who murdered a Palestinian in cold blood. He was found guilty of manslaughter and will be sentenced in about a month or so in Israel. Now, without wishing to go into too much detail about that case, the public opinion around that case has been fundamentally in support of him. And the reason I mention that is that it gives you a sense that a soldier who was captured on film, murdering a Palestinian in cold blood is given the majority Israeli public support. And people who are critical of that, who say it's murder, someone like that needs to be put in jail, needs to be sanctioned in some way, those voices are increasingly not just marginalized, but said to be treacherous. And when you move into a space in a so-called democracy like Israel, where views are seen as treacherous when they're critical of the state, which I might add is happening increasingly in the US, not just since Trump has won, was happening, I think, during Obama too, but it's going to happen more and more now that Trump is president in a few weeks, then we have a problem. And so that's my general situation, that I am fighting for my rights here to stay. I'm fighting for my rights to be a journalist. I'm fighting for my rights to be a critical reporter. And I've been pleased with the support that I've received, but also saddened by the number of journalists who have not come out and showed support, right, both in Israel and elsewhere. And that's noted, because I think a lot of journalists who have contacted me privately here in Israel, these are foreign journalists who are based in Israel proper, working for some of the large Western media organizations, either in the US or the UK, have said that they are increasingly concerned themselves about the environment within Israel against journalists. So my response to that is, you should speak out.
Right.
Like, what are you waiting for? You should speak out now. You know, you have a accepted visa with a large news organization who's going to back you up. I have no news organization backing me up. You guys work for some of the largest media groups in the world, Esty, and they're not speaking out. That, to me, is really shameless.
I couldn't agree with you more. This is Middle East in Focus. I am joined by independent journalist Antony Lowenstein, discussing the threat by Israel's government press office not to renew his press card after a right-wing media watchdog group accused him of being an advocate for BDS. You did mention that you have received some support, including from your own union, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance Union, which is Australia's leading media union. They sent a letter of in support of you to the Israeli ambassador in Australia, the Australian ambassador in Israel, and the Israeli government press office. I wonder if there have been any responses to that letter.
As far as I know, absolutely nothing. I haven't been told that there has. I'm in touch with the union, and they haven't told me that there has been. So let's presume that the answer is nothing. I also know that the Centre for Investigative Journalism, which is one of Britain's leading journalism schools, sent letters to the three top people at the Israeli press office here in Israel in late 2016. There's been little response to that either, except for one belligerent letter, which essentially told them to get stuffed in polite terms. Aside from that, nothing. And I think it's worrying to me that more journalists haven't come out and supported. Not just a question of supporting me. It's not really about me. Yes, I have a personal situation and a personal stake in the story, obviously, but the broader issue here, that what happens to me today is going to happen to other people tomorrow.
That's
and
right.
Inevitably, that's exactly where Israel is going. And these journalists who I'm speaking to privately are not, to be fair, saying Israel is a glorious democracy. They know and acknowledge that it's not, especially towards dissent. But to me, I think there is too much of a cozy club here that is not one to upset an Israeli state that they worry will kick them out themselves.
And that's not unique to Israel. I mean, we have the same problem here.
Agreed.
With the tug between access and actually doing your job of journalism. We have only a couple minutes left, so I do just want to ask you, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the incoming U.S. President-elect, Trump, that's the first time I've said that out loud, share an extreme...
It didn't feel good.
It did not feel good. They share this extreme sensitivity to criticism and the desire to control public information, which does not bode well at all for journalistic freedom. I wonder how you anticipate their relationship playing out over the next year in 1 minute.
In the U.S. or in Israel? Or both?
Both.
Well, I think in both cases, I think, or very briefly, one, I think Trump is going to embolden the worst excesses of Israeli society, which is massively expanding settlements, being probably moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. I think there's a good chance that'll happen. Selling Israel more weapons like they need any more anyway. And I think support, again, the most extreme elements of Israeli society, which, by the way, is not Netanyahu. Netanyahu is moderate compared to some of the more extremists who are looking to be in government. I think what's going to be required, though, from journalism is to be far more aggressive, to resist. And that could well be court cases, that could be literally civil disobedience. I think it's going to be necessary. I think it's almost inevitable that there'll be journalists or media organizations in the US that'll be sued by Trump or people around him. How are media organizations going to deal with that? Are they going to have, for example, their servers based in the US? They're going to have their servers based elsewhere. This became an issue with China when the Chinese government, for example, asked or demanded companies like Google and others to give them certain personal information. I think it's a really interesting question that media organizations, New York Times, Washington Post, from the big ones to the small ones, should think seriously about where their data is stored. I haven't got a particular answer where it should be stored, but maybe not in the US solely. I think resistance is going to be key here, and I think journalism, some journalists undeniably are aware of that and everybody's speaking in those terms. Others, I think, are going to be far too willing to accommodate what is clearly in Israel and the US an extremist agenda. And that, to me, should be resisted in all possible ways.
You're very right about that, and it'll be very interesting to see how that relationship plays out, whether American media becomes less free. You know, Israel doesn't even claim to have freedom of the press. They don't have freedom of the press, and we'll see if that happens here as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some media outlets that have spoken now, even before Trump comes into power, of being far more aggressive against his statements, against his policies, and that's to be welcomed. But I think somehow that a lot of the more liberal media organizations in the U.S., most of whom that clearly missed the so-called Trump revolution, for want of a better expression, need to toughen up, because Trump does not play by the rules. So therefore, I'm not saying for a second that one should not play by the rules oneself. That's not what I think at all. But I do think that journalists as well need to be far more aggressive about not playing solely the he said, she said game. And the New York Times, for example, consistently still takes the argument wrongly, which is publishing too many anonymously sourced stories, particularly when it comes to national security and foreign policy. It's a fundamental problem of journalism. Embedding, as I often say, SD, is not just the idea of being with US or British or Australian forces in a war zone. Embedding also happens psychologically. And too many journalists, I think, are far too comfortable around power, whether it's Republican or Democrat. And I think too many of them are going to adapt too quickly to a Trump administration. We'll have to wait and see. I hope not.
Well, we will wait and see, and we will follow your story and continue to cover it. All the best to you, and thank you very, very much for taking the time to explain what's going on there with us here on Middle East in Focus.
And thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Esty.
Talk to you again soon. Since 2007, Muslims for Progressive Values, or MPV, has worked to nurture and establish vibrant progressive Muslim communities worldwide. MPV envisions a future where Islam is understood as a source of dignity, justice, compassion, and love for all of humanity and the world, which is what they have modeled here for nearly a decade in Los Angeles, as well as 11 other American cities and 7 other nations. Muslims for Progressive Values is a very real counter-narrative to radicalism and intolerance. I am very happy to be joined in studio once again by the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, Ani Zonneveld. Ani Zonneveld is a writer, singer-songwriter, speaker, human rights defender, and, as mentioned, is the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. Founded here in L.A. in 2007, MPV is a grassroots, faith-based human rights organization that advocates for egalitarian expressions of Islam, for women's rights, LGBTQI rights, freedom of expression, and freedom of and from religion or belief. MPV promotes these values, including at the United Nations, by challenging human rights abuses in the name of Islam, and by offering an inclusive understanding based on universal human rights and justice through its presence in 12 cities and 8 countries. Ani Zonneveld was born and raised Muslim from Malaysia. Her message of social justice, human rights, and peace from a progressive Muslim woman's perspective is indeed infused in all of her work, including her beautiful singing and songwriting. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ani Zonneveld back to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you, Esty.
Well, it's always wonderful having you, and I'm so in awe of your work. Advocating for egalitarian expressions of Islam, for women's rights, LGBTQI rights, freedom of expression, and freedom of and from religion or belief in 12 cities and 8 countries is an extraordinary human rights mission. Can you describe for us briefly the different areas that MPV focuses on to make those ideals real for more people every year?
For the most visible change that we've seen has been in some of our work here in the United States, but also at the United Nations. For example, a lot of times when we challenge much of the human rights abuses in the Muslim majority countries at the United Nations, we filed the reports and we actually counter them verbatim. So, for example, when Somalia or Sudan or any of these countries justify a child marriage and they justify it, oh, it's our religion. Well, we go in there and say, well, that's not true. Sharia law is a man-made construct. The Quran is very clear that marriage is between two consenting adults of sound mind. So we file those reports, we challenge that. And what's really nice is that the member states, the countries at the United Nations are starting to sit up and listen and actually use our language. We've also translated in Somali, for example, and Scandinavian countries have actually used our report on the ground to educate Somalis and other African countries using Islamic language in affirming girls' and women's rights. That's just one example how, at the end of the day, we have to re-educate Muslims about what Islam and what the Quran actually says than rather what your twisted, corrupted imam is saying. And that's the problem with the Muslim world, is that we have a lot of money being put into promoting intolerant, hateful, bastardized version of supposedly Islam, and therefore we have this mayhem in the Muslim world.
And that's true for the Christian world and the Jewish world as well, but I understand it's a huge undertaking. So in recognition of MPV's extraordinary work, in 2013, Muslims for Progressive Values was given consultative status at the United Nations. Can you explain what that is and how it has worked to elevate MPV's work to new levels?
Yeah. Because we have been doing all this human rights work here in the United States and through our affiliates in other countries, we've been able to file at the United Nations as a consultative status. That means that they recognize us as a nonprofit or an NGO that works within the context of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And so, so you pass that several steps of application and you get accepted into the UN system. And that enables us to sit at the table and enables us to actually insert language. For example, when they were drafting the Sustainable Development Goals for 2030, we were there negotiating language. No, religion and culture should not trump human rights. And it was us, Muslims for Progressive Values, that insisted on that language. And for a lot of faith-based organizations and other non-faith-based organizations, it was really shocking to see this small Muslim organization. And we are small.
But mighty.
But mighty. To really nitpick on language, because it's a legal document that all the member states have adopted.
Right. I know that when people ask me, have you heard about this great organization? I said, they were the first organization to reach out when my organization, Jewish Voice for Peace, Los Angeles, launched. So I've been in awe of your work for a long time. So as with most advocacy work, education is key. Can you talk a bit more about some of Muslims for Progressive Values' educational work and projects?
We have one program called Imams for She, where we work with affirming egalitarian and inclusive-minded imams all over the world. And unfortunately, there's very few of them in America. We work a lot with imams in the Muslim-majority communities. For example, in Tunisia, we're working with an iconic scholar of Islam and human rights defender, Iyad Ben Ashour. He's Tunisian, and he's like your Martin Luther King, you know. So he's an ally of ours, and loves the work that we do. We also are going to be working with the head of the Tunisian Union of Imams. There are a lot of unions in Tunisia, including imams. We work with 26 imams in Burundi, and they're having a tough time because you have these young imams that are radicalized, and they go to our friend in Saudi Arabia and come back with a stash of money and set up these, you know, intolerant, hateful, you know, a la Boko Haram sort of propagation, right? And so it's becoming an issue. But we work with these imams because, you know, at the end of the day, it is affecting this hate and intolerance and misogynistic and this blasphemy theology is really affecting their community, their society. And they are the one at the receiving end. And there are imams that are killed for it, for advocating for human rights for all. And those are the voices that we have to support. You know, many of us sitting here, we're very privileged. And for a lot of the Muslims here and for the imams in particular, it's really quite despicable how they have shunned this responsibility. As far as I'm concerned, it is our duty as privileged Muslims to care about the rights of others, not just our Muslim right.
Sure, sure. And also education for women, which has been an issue in some of those places.
Education, you know, this re-education of Muslims, of Islam for Muslims is really needed. I mean, let's take the fact of what Sharia law is. Everyone is freaking out about Sharia law in the American context even. But, you know, there is a real distinction between Sharia and Sharia law. You know, Sharia is basically a guideline of how to live a good ethical life. It's, you know, it's described in the Quran as the watering hole that quenches your spiritual thirst. But, you know, Sharia law is an extrapolation by medieval politicians of the day, and of course with their misogynistic and egotistic mindset, right? And so they've included cultural and non-cultural and secular norms of the day and cultural norms of the day like female genital mutilation and cutting, child marriage, forced marriage, you know, blasphemy laws. There's no such thing as blasphemy law in the Quran. And yet, in the Muslim world, everybody thinks that, oh, if you leave Islam or if you talk negatively about Islam, you're punished, you know, even hung.
Wow.
Right? That's how twisted it's become.
Right.
So we all need to get re-educated about what Islam, what the Quran actually says. And the religious teachers of the day of today here particularly are doing a pathetic job. And that's why we have Islamophobia.
That's right. Well, and that's why people like you and I are out here fighting against it. I am joined by Ani Sonnenfeld, the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values here on Middle East in Focus. We're discussing MPV's groundbreaking work advocating for egalitarian expressions of Islam, for women's rights, LGBTQI rights, and other freedoms in the work that they do in 12 cities in America and 8 countries across the globe. MPV is unique in that your monitoring of human rights issues in Muslim-majority countries includes that related to women's rights, LGBTQI rights, freedom from religion, of religion. Can you give us some examples of the work that you've been able to accomplish in those fields over the last few years?
The work that we do at Muslims for Progressive Values is really rooted in the Quran, and we look at the Quran as an inspiration, an impetus in social justice, just like Jesus was, just like so many other prophets, right? And Muhammad was the one who revealed the Quran, and so we look at the Quran as our inspiration. Our work is rooted in that. We use sacred texts to defend human rights. So, for example, when we have Raif Badawi, who is a Saudi young man, a blogger, who challenges the status quo in Saudi Arabia, politically or religiously. It's various twisted religious interpretations. We are the Muslim organization that defends his right, defended, was the first one to defend his right, and still is defending his right in the context of Islam. At the United Nations with LGBT rights, we are the Muslim organization that defends LGBT rights in the context of Islam. No other organization does that. And we do that on the basis of human dignity. We do that on the basis that in the Quran there is no punishment for being homosexual, nor did Prophet Muhammad actually punish anyone for being homosexual. Yet, in every Muslim majority country, for the most part, not every, take it, Tunisia is excluded legally, yeah, or Jordan, in Turkey, there's no punishment from being homosexual, but society does not accept them still. So I think the promotion of human dignity, if Islam is claimed to be the religion of peace, then well, we have to treat human beings with dignity, with respect, and in a just form, not when it suits yourself. On the issue of blasphemy, we have challenged a lot of the blasphemy laws and we at the United Nations and also on the ground. So, for example, when we were doing a report on Sudan and Somalia on blasphemy, how it is un-Islamic to just throw anyone in jail just because they are challenging various interpretations of Islam. A Somali professor who wrote a book in Somalia on how blasphemy is not Islamic. He was threatened and he had to leave Somalia, and now he's a refugee in Kenya. And he's not in a good situation. Here's an educated Muslim educator, right? In Mauritania, another man who comes from a heritage of slaves. Slavery was just abolished in Mauritania, I think in 1984 or 87.
Wow.
This is very recent. And so the mindset is still there, right? So if you're black and you're a certain particular occupation, you are from the slaves in heritage. And so he was actually challenging how this has nothing to do with Islam. And guess what? He's in jail right now, right? Wow. And waiting for potentially a death sentence. So this is the kind of injustice, and this, as a Muslim who speaks up from the Muslim perspective, from a Quran, it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, I've had conversations with these Muslims who have been persecuted in the name of Islam, and I have to tell you, I want to share this with your audience. For them, they detest Islam in a very deep way, and I completely understand that. So when they speak to me and they see a Muslim organization that defends their rights in the context of Islam, it diffuses that hate. And we've had some times where we laugh about it. It's like, oh, I hate all Muslims, they say. You know, it's like, and like, yeah, me too. Sometimes I hate them too, you know. But it's frustrating sometimes when you have these immense powers.
Right. And it's not about Islam. It's about the way that some people are using it and teaching it. That's
right. It's political. Political and money.
Always.
I need that oil field. People, someone, give me an oil field because I need an oil field to fund our work.
Well, I don't have an oil field for you, but you guys actually have a much better idea. Next Sunday is Muslim for Progressive Values annual celebration of life, which is always a very elegant and unique and moving event. Last year, I don't know if there was a dry eye in the house. Can you tell us what you have planned for this year's event, which is this next Sunday, the 15th, and where people can get tickets?
Celebration of Life is a way for us to exemplify our work defending human Muslims who are progressive in the Muslim world, who have spoken up and as a result of that have been prosecuted, jailed, tortured, or killed. And we do that by inviting celebrity names to read in the first person of the honorees, these human rights defenders in the Muslim world. Because primarily we were quite sick and tired of the media asking, where are the progressive Muslims? Well, here we are. We've been here for 10 years in the United States, but in the Muslim world, this is what's happening to them. So read. And you can get tickets. Go to our website, mpvusa.org, and there's links to our ticket Eventbrite page where we sell the tickets. We're honoring Bassem Youssef, who is an Egyptian who challenged Mubarak, who challenged Morsi, who challenged Sisi, and as a result of that was in under tremendous threat, and he had to flee within 24 hours. We are honoring him with a Batsha Khan Beacon of Truth Award, because it's people like him who have sacrificed everything, literally everything. He's a surgeon, and used his unique talent of satirical comedy and his television show as a way to challenge authority and to do it. It takes a lot of guts. So for us here in America, it's like we need to respect people like that. And so we're giving him this award. He's going to be there along with actress, Oscar nominee and Emmy winner, Shohreh Akhdashloo, and Jay Abdo, who's a Syrian. Yes, yes. And Congressman Price from the 9th District, because he addresses issues of the arts and how culture and arts is important. So we're linking all this. This particular year is a theme of arts and how arts, human rights defender, and how human rights defenders have used arts as a way to express their particular positions.
Which is a really, really smart thing. We've seen the effect it's had in this country in regards to LGBTQI rights. This is Middle East in Focus. I am joined in studio by Ani Sonnenfeld. We're discussing the annual celebration of life, a wonderful event done by Muslims for Progressive Values.
It's in at CBS on Redford. And again, it's mpvusa.org.
And as you began, there's always telling us there's always a great list of honorees. Can you talk about some of the other honorees that people will?
Yes, absolutely. There's Amjad Sabri, who was a phenomenal Pakistani Sufi singer, well renowned for his Qawwali music, spiritual Islamic music, and he was killed. And then there's Ashraf Fayad, a Palestinian poet in prison in Saudi Arabia since 2014, charged with apostasy for promoting atheism. And this Paradis Suri, an Afghanistani female rapper. Hila Siddiqui, who is a Iranian young woman poet, and Shohreh is going to be reading as Hila. And again, these, and then Kandil Baloch, who is a Pakistani young woman who was killed by her brother in so-called honor killing, because she was very provocative, very sensual, and for us, she represents everything that a woman has the right to express. And we see too much of the censorship of a woman's skin, hair, voice, even sexual satisfaction in the form of female genital mutilation and cutting. And so for us, this is unacceptable. A woman should be able to express however she wants.
And was she a performer?
She was a performer, and she became a social media sensation. Sexually, in her sexualization, and in just her freedom, the guts for her to express whatever she wanted to express, right, in a society that is censored and killed off. People are killed off for supporting freedom of religion or against blasphemy. Right? They're literally killed off, right, and here she is speaking freely as a woman.
Right, and we talk about the challenges that we have. I mean, it's not easy to do what you've done, even here in the United States.
We're still, you know, trying to fight for our rights to for female reproductive rights. It's ridiculous.
Right, but we're also supposed to have freedom of religion, yes, and we know that within our own religious communities, it's not always the case. And
trust
there
me,
is,
I know that.
I can only imagine, and it's why I've always been in awe of your work. And why so many people have stood up, have listened, who've taken notice. It's very, very brave and groundbreaking, the work that you are doing. And massively important.
I have to say that what we're doing is, you know, we've been accused of being sort of the fringe, but the actuality is that progressive Muslims are in America are not fringe.
That's right.
Actually, most American Muslims don't attend mosques because they don't subscribe to the culture at the mosque, the misogynistic, the homophobic, the lack of space to express yourself freely. And so progressive Muslims are all over America. We are the majority. It's just that we're not as organized or deep-pocketed like the rest of them. So like the dominant voices. And what I'm really proud about, what the work that we've done in America, is that because of our mere presence and the positions that we've taken, we've really challenged the status quo. And we've seen now actually Muslims in America having the conversation about blasphemy, or how it's really not rooted in Islam. We're actually having this conversation in America, but only in university settings, not in the mosque.
So in university settings, not in the mosque, okay?
Well, we hope that that will continue to be the case, and that we're seeing clampdowns on some conversations in university settings, and we're hoping that they won't try tricking these kinds of very, very important conversations that are happening. Looking forward again to the celebration of life this next Sunday, January 15th, at CBS Studio Center. We will put up all the information about it on our Facebook page. Thanks again for coming in, Ani Sonnenfeld.
Thank you for having me.
Bigotry can be the result of ignorance, but it is more often the result of fear. And as many of us are learning anew, fear is impervious to data, facts, information, and history books. The best way to dissipate fear about people we don't know is to get to know some of those people. Learning about people, hearing their stories, figuring out that they are dealing with the same struggles, experiencing the same joys, laughing and crying at the same movies, trying their food, listening to their music, and sharing our own favorites is what actually dissolves the walls in people's hearts and minds. If we want people to be more understanding and tolerant of those from different countries, of different ethnicities, religions, and cultures, we can be proactive. We can choose to toss a pebble into the pond by reaching out to someone who we think doesn't agree with us or share our values, and try to get to know them a little bit better. As Gandhi taught, we should always be the change that we want to see in the world. Once again, I want to thank my guests, Middle East-based freelance Australian journalist, author, documentarian, and blogger Anthony Lowenstein. You can read his work on his website, antonylowenstein.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at @AntLowenstein. And writer, singer, human rights defender, and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, Ani Sonnenfeld. MPV's annual Celebration of Life is next Sunday, January 15th. You can buy tickets at mpvusa.org and follow MPV on Twitter at @MPVUSA. We will post links to both of our guest websites on our Middle East in Focus Facebook page. Liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter are the best ways to keep up with the work of our many guests and friends of the show. I also want to thank our fantastic engineer. Our theme song is the overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. The only reason we can bring you this show is because you, our audience, support it financially. Your pledges power this show and KPFK Independent Radio. We thank you and hope you will keep listening and continue to support us. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for taking this hour to put the Middle East in focus.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster. Join me Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. for Reggae Central. You'll hear ska, rock steady, reggae, roots, dub, and dancehall. You'll hear it all on Reggae Central right here on KPFK, Sunday afternoons from 2 to 4.
Hi, I'm Lila Garrett, host of Connect the Dots. Monday morning at 7 on Connect the Dots, with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, we discuss the growing insistence by the United States intelligence agencies that Russia hacked our election and where it may lead. With Jody Evans, co-founder of the powerful peace action group Code Pink, we are invited to join their grassroots efforts between January 19th and 21st in stopping the Trump administration from usurping our democracy. And with actor Ed Asner, we address a bold new full-page New York Times ad placed by a group named RefuseFascism.org. Ed Asner, among thousands of others, is a signatory to that ad. That's Monday morning at 7 on Connect the Dots.
The Irvine Barclay Theater presents the legendary singing group Ladysmith Black Mambazo on Thursday, January 19th at 8 p.m. The Grammy Award-winning ensemble will perform songs in the intricate rhythms and harmonies of their native South Africa tradition at the Barclay Theater, 4242 Campus Drive in Irvine. For tickets and more information, go to kpfk.org or call 949-854-4646. That's 949-854-4646. KPFK is a proud media partner of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, live at the Irvine Barclay, Thursday 19th at 8 p.m.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles,
98.7 FM Santa Barbara,
93.7 San Diego,
99.5 Ridgecrest and China Lake,
and for the world at kpfk.org.